Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, good morning. I am Judy Morgan, State Representative for the 24th Legislative District in Missouri.
Judy Morgan, our first ever Missouri State House Blend guest a year ago, is back. Let's play the open.
This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. Welcome to the production studio at KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison, and it is good to be here with Representative Judy Morgan. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here on a beautiful morning.
And we are also here with KCUR News Director Maria Carter.
Glad to be here as well. There's nothing like work on a Saturday.
We've got the donuts to make that just a little bit better and the freshly brewed coffee so we can get started. And like I said, Judy, you occupy this very special place in State House Blend history that you actually were our very first Missouri representative.
Oh, that's right. I remember because you were doing a lot of Kansas.
Right.
Yeah.
It started as a Kansas
stuff.
Show. So thanks for bringing it full circle.
Oh, and I'm happy to do that.
We've honored Judy by rolling out our State House Blend mugs with this episode.
Which they are really nice. I love the colors.
we'll post pictures of that online so everyone can see them. Any developments, Judy, with your pets and family since we last spoke?
Oh, well, actually, I think there is. I have a daughter who lives in the St. Louis area, and she has a little 3.5-year-old boy, but she's expecting a daughter in not too long, about 6 weeks away. So
Another grandchild.
The two little doggies, little Leo and Dylan, are two little miniature dachshunds. They are still with us, thank goodness. I can't remember if I was here before or after. We had an escapade with one of our dogs.
Oh,
where my husband was out running with them, and they got attacked by another dog, and one dog took off, and he was gone for like 36 hours, somehow found his way back to our house, and we were very happy when we saw him. So our little two doggies are intact.
Well, that is good. That would be a very scary thing
for a dog owner. It really was.
Well, we're glad that you're here, and full disclosure, Judy is in fact my state representative here in the Midtown Kansas City area, but we'll still try to be objective about that.
You'll have your list of complaints ready.
That's right. My main questions are about potholes. No.
Okay. Yeah, which we don't really. Well, we would deal with them if we could ever take care of that transportation bill.
That's true. That was a nice segue to the transportation issue. But before we get to all that, we're going to go to my colleague Maria Carter and see what's on her mind this morning.
One of the things I was thinking about is, about women in politics. We have Hillary Clinton running for president. Mm-hmm. A historic moment there. But then I think you look at our state legislatures and the people in Missouri running for those state offices, not many of them are women.
Right.
And just kind of, I think in the past, maybe there have been more. And, I think at this point, I might expect to see more women in these top jobs or running for
right.
them.
Right. No, I agree.
And I was just wondering, what were your thoughts about, why more women aren't pursuing the political realm?
Well, right now in the Missouri State House, about 25% of us are women. And, of course, we do make up a little more, I believe, than 50% of the population. So we're definitely way down. Some of the information that I've learned and read, a lot of times women don't really think about running on their own. Men do. Men are very, assertive, and they say, I can do this job. I'm going to go ahead and do it. Women don't. And normally, I'm actually a prototype of this. You don't run unless somebody you respect asks you to run. And so most women don't think about running until someone that they respect in their careers or their, the professional life or their personal life, and that person comes to them and says, hey, I think you'd really be good for this job. And that's exactly what happened to me. Two of my friends who are strong in the labor movement as I am came to me, and when there was a vacancy in this House position, and they said, we think you should run for this. And that's why I ran. So I think that's part of it, is that women don't have it kind of built into their DNA as much to take these things on. I think I see that changing some with the younger women, mm-hmm. which I think is really good.
Yeah.
Like you said, at the statewide level, though, like right now we do have a woman who's our auditor, but she was appointed to that position by Governor Nixon when our former auditor committed suicide. You may remember
Tom
about
Schweig,
that.
Right.
Yeah, Tom Schweig. And so she is really dynamite, in my opinion. She had been in a I can't remember. I think it wasn't treasurer, but it was some position like that in Boone County, mm-hmm. which is the Columbia area. And so, you know, she did have financial experience, and she was appointed auditor. Then we have one woman running for attorney general, Teresa Hensley, yeah. and one woman running for secretary of state, Robin Smith. That's probably more than we've had
yeah.
in a long time. Now, Nicole doesn't have to run until 18. The auditor's in the off-year yeah. elections. So I think that's part of it is women just, you know, we don't think about running as much as men do.
Yeah, if you're not running for the state rep position yeah. early on, you're not right. in a position to right. run for higher offices
right.
necessarily
right.
down the road.
Right, right, exactly. So, but I think that's starting to change, thankfully.
Is the environment changing? I mean, a year ago, when you were here, we spoke about the sexual harassment claims mm-hmm. being made against certain legislators. There were the intern scandals in
right.
Jeff City. This year has been relatively scandal-free in that mm-hmm. department. I mean, has the environment changed significantly for women in Jeff City?
Well, I think it's changed in some ways. I mean, the new Speaker of the House, although I, you know, ideologically we're very different in terms of our points of view, but I do think he's set a tone that people should come down there to do their jobs and there shouldn't be any messing around on the side. Mm-hmm. So I think he has kind of set a tone.
None of this, what happens in Jeff City stays
yeah,
in Jeff City.
Right, right. So
Jeff City never sounded that exciting.
right.
I know, you're right. No. But so on that level, I think maybe it's gotten a little bit better, but I still think it's more difficult for women to kind of crack into leadership positions within their own party. And I think there still is.
And that's true for Democrats as well as Republicans?
Yes, I think so. I think maybe even more so for Republicans than Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
I think as in fact, in the Democratic caucus, we are a higher percentage as women. I think we are closer to maybe 30 or 35%. And the Republican women are a little bit less than the 25%, which averages out to there's about the same amount of Democratic women as there are Republican women, but there's a lot more Republicans down there in general. So
yeah.
So we make up a bigger share of the gender of our caucus than the Republicans do.
And just in the I think two, maybe three state house blends I've been on now, you know, one I was on with another woman who from Kansas, and she got into politics after retiring. And I was wondering almost if that was part of it, if women still kind of are called upon to do a lot of the household stuff in addition to having a job a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they don't have the extra free time,
right.
to take on a third thing, politics.
Right. Right. No, I think you've got a good point that there are a lot of, even like in both the Republican and Democratic caucuses, a number of the women are already retired. That is true. And so it makes it, you know, it's pretty ideal for us to run for office at that point in our lives because we don't have the other commitments. And, you know, running for office, it's not just the job you do as state rep, but you've actually got to run a campaign every 2 years if you're a rep or 4 years if you're a Senate. So that takes time, too. So I think that does have something to do with it.
Yeah, we have a lot of campaign and election stuff to talk about, given where we are in the year. Before we go there, I want to let us dwell just a little longer in the legislative session just completed. As you look back on this session, obviously there were a lot of pieces of legislation that the Republican majority wanted to see. There were others that they talked about wanting to see that never came to be, mm-hmm. including in the area of campaign finance and, mm-hmm. and some of the ethical reforms. As you look back on this session, what do you think is the most significant thing that happened?
In terms of a negative that I think happened, maybe a couple of things. One, the gun bill that passed. I mean, that is a significant piece of legislation.
The Stand Your Ground law.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and also that you don't have to, have a permit to conceal and carry. So that means just not that you don't go through the process of getting the permit, the background check. You also do not go through the training. There's an 8-hour training session right now with getting a permit. So in my opinion, that's a negative thing, but I think it was a significant thing that was passed last year.
And it passed in the last week of the session.
It actually passed in the last about 2 hours of the last day of the session. I mean, it was that right there at the very end. I mean, it was a Senate bill, so the Senate did it real fast, and they quickly sent it over to the House. And, you know, we had minutes notice that it was headed over to us. So we were jumping up on the floor, you know, ready to debate it. And
we've had other legislators comment on why they think it happened that way. Why do you think it happened that way?
Well, I think part of it was just sometimes it takes a while to get through the process. And I think that there were some other things they were thinking about. And, you know, I don't know that I think there was anything out of the ordinary. I think a lot of times that happens. A lot of the stuff they're really wanting takes till the very end to get it through.
Well, as journalists, we understand deadlines.
So. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So,
right.
And you know, like I say, it just really, it's one, and it does have the stand your ground in it, like you said. And we're the first state to pass that since the Trayvon Martin killing in Florida, which I think was 4 years ago.
And it passed pretty convincingly. It passed with a veto-proof majority in both
yes.
the House and the Senate.
Yes.
That was before the Orlando shootings.
Yes.
Do you sense that veto, the governor vetoed the
yes,
bill,
he
we
did.
Should mention, but
he
the,
did.
The override session is coming up September 14th.
Yes.
Do you think the veto will be overridden?
I think there is some effort on the part of law enforcement to come out against the bill, which I think is positive. Whether it will be enough to change those votes, I am doubtful.
Hmm.
I regret to say.
Yeah, even in the midst of a campaign season, and even in the, or maybe is it because it's in the midst of a campaign season?
Yeah, well, I think part of, and a lot of the individuals who voted for that bill just really believe that that's the way it should be. And I'm not sure that anything would convince them to do otherwise. Now, I hope I'm proven wrong, very much so, and that, you know, somehow law enforcement, because I think law enforcement is the best bet in terms of a leverage to bring pressure on people to change their minds, because I think they do carry some weight in this area. So, but yeah, there were even several Democrats that live in areas where they feel there's a lot of you know, gun rights advocates that they voted for it. So it was, and I don't believe any, I can't remember, but I don't think any Republican voted against it. Or if they did, it, you know, very
right.
few, but not,
right.
maybe not even any.
Mm. Are there any other vetoes? Or go ahead.
I was going to say the other significant thing, I think, is that we didn't pass a transportation bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
speaking of the potholes.
Yeah,
right.
yeah. And I think that's at the crisis stage, in my opinion. And it actually was, interestingly, it was the Senate actually passed a bill that was a very modest increase in the gasoline tax. It was like about 6 cents a gallon. Ours is at 17 cents a gallon. We're like very near the bottom in terms of our gasoline tax. It would have still kept us very near the bottom, even mm-hmm. with raising it to like 23 cents a gallon. The Senate actually passed it, and the House leadership would not take it up. And at least what people were saying why it was not taken up was because it was an election season, and the House leadership did not want to, the House Republican leadership did not want to force their members
to vote
on what would something would be seen as a tax increase. And the Senate passed it, and it was obviously there were some Republicans who voted against it, but enough of them joined the Democrats to vote for it that it passed in the Senate, and we couldn't get it through the House.
It's always an issue that fascinates me, Judy, because we've had conservative Republicans here and progressive liberal Democrats mm-hmm. sitting here who all alike say transportation is a top priority.
Mm-hmm.
Infrastructure funding is absolutely essential. We've had members of Republican leadership say that.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think this is so vexing? Why can this particular issue not find resolution in Jeff City?
Well, I think the only way you're going to find resolution to it is you've got to find a funding source. And a funding source means you have to do something to raise taxes. I don't know if you'll recall, but you know, we tried an amendment to the Constitution that would have, it would have been a sales tax.
Essentially built
yeah.
it into
yeah,
the...
Right. Yeah, right. And a lot of progressive groups were against that, and I understand why they were, because sales taxes are regressive taxes, and they do hurt poor and middle-income people more than rich people. But you're going to have to find a funding source, and that's going to somehow involve, I think, taxes in some way, or a toll tax, you know, something.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's only about three ways: sales tax, gasoline tax, toll tax, a toll on the
yeah.
roads. And I just think that the Republicans, sometimes they don't want to have anything to do with any kind of tax increase. And I don't see any other way. I mean, I really believe that our state budget, it's been cut a lot over the years. the legislature has given a lot of tax breaks over the years, which meant not as much tax income is coming in. Some of those were probably good, some were bad, but you're going to have to find. I don't think you're going to find the funding source in the current revenues. You're going to have to find a new revenue, and that's the problem.
Is it important enough that maybe there should be cuts in spending in other areas to pay for transportation?
Well, the problem is, I think we are getting down to where we're providing mostly just the essential, education. I don't want to see cuts in education. I mean, we just did go through where we changed our foundation formula so that schools are going to get less money, which I voted against. But, we have our Medicaid population in terms of health care, which I think needs to be continued to be funded. We have our correction system with, you can't just, I think they're doing well with what they've got. Our state employees are the lowest paid in the whole United States, so I sure don't want to cut their salaries. So I don't think there's a lot of room in the budget, to do that. And in our budget, we've got our state funds, our federal funds, and then there's other funds that are directed toward conservation and other kinds mm-hmm. of things. And so all we really have are those state funds, which are like about a third of the revenue. A third of it's federal, and we really have no, those have requirements that we have to fulfill. And then the other third's this designated money that we can't touch. So I think we're going to have to come up with some money somewhere.
All right. Well, I do want to move on to campaign season, but Maria, what else is on your mind?
One of the things, and probably goes back a bit to the stand your ground gun kind mm-hmm. of conversation. It's just the rural-urban divide in Missouri. And, I think mayors in both cities have really advocated for stronger gun
laws. Yes, they definitely have.
Or
you're right.
At least the right to have stronger gun laws in their areas. And I think get really frustrated by, the legislature, and that has a different feeling than that. And I was, I've just kind of been wondering, where is there a compromise to be had there? But they just seem like so two radically different views of kind of the issue that it's hard to imagine a compromise that works.
Yeah, I believe there is a rural-urban divide, not just in Missouri, but probably across the country. The New York Times did a great article about it about a year ago, and it seems to be that, like-minded people kind of move to the same areas. So in the urban areas, you've got like-minded people moving there, and the rural areas, like-minded people, but we're pretty different in terms of our likes and dislikes. Mm-hmm. And that's what then, makes this dynamic where it's really difficult to compromise. Then you put the whole redistricting on top of it, at both the state and national level, where so many of the districts are compiled in such a way that, it's either a Democratic or a Republican district. And so what happens then is when you have primaries, when people have to face primaries, the Republicans, they're going to the right. The Democrats are going to the left because that's the primary voters mm-hmm. that come out are generally on either end. So you have this dynamic where there's just not very many competitive districts or swing districts anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm obviously a perfect example of that with an 83% Democratic district. And on the other hand, there's a number of Republican districts that are just that much Republican. So it does make it more difficult.
But to Maria's point, so then you end up with a Democratic nominee for governor, Chris Koster, mm-hmm. who has an A rating from the NRA.
Right.
He is a former Republican. He has mm-hmm. he has basically received some not so veiled criticism from Kansas City Mayor Sly James for not being tough enough on guns. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? When is that because the only way that a Democratic governor has a chance of being elected in Missouri is to move that far to the center or even the right?
Well, I think that I don't think somebody like me could probably be elected to a statewide office with my very progressive views that fit very well with my district. District is a very progressive district. I'm not sure that I could be elected statewide because of those progressive views. I think Missouri is more of a center-right state in general. Take away the redistricting, it's a little bit more center-right. So I think at the statewide level, I'm not sure if you have to go quite as far as some of the statewide candidates have gone, but I do think it's probably, it is more of a center-right Although it's interesting because, you know, we do have Democrats get elected. You know, what we have now, 5 of the 6 statewide offices, 1 was appointed, Nicole Galloway, the other 4 were elected. Mm-hmm. So we have the Democrats have 5 of the 6 statewide elected offices, and yet we are only about 25% of the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And I think that is because of the redistricting. And yet when you go across the whole state, enough of a coalition can be put together to elect a Democrat, yeah. Sometimes very narrowly, as you may recall, both Clinton Zweifel, the treasurer, and Jason Kander, Secretary of State, won by 51% or something like that. It was now Nixon and Koster won by a greater percentage.
Let's talk about Koster and Chris Koster, the Democratic nominee, facing Eric Greitens, a political novice, the Republican nominee. What are your thoughts about that race? As you said, you are more progressive. Your district is more progressive than the Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. He's picking up endorsements from the Farm Bureau and
soybean corn association. Right. Yeah. I just read about those two recently.
Historic in that they've never endorsed a Democrat before. I suspect you'll be supporting the Democratic nominee,
yes.
But what do you make of that when neither candidate is representing sort of the progressive views that you have been putting forward?
Well, and I guess I do have some pragmatism to my political life, and I don't expect that the person running for statewide office is going to hold all of my points of view, and I will. Generally, the Democrat holds a lot more than the Republican does, and so I go with the Democrat. And Koster he's very good on public education, in my opinion. He really believes in funding the foundation formula. He's very good on labor union issues. I think he's going to be very good on Medicaid expansion. He really believes in Medicaid expansion, and that is something that is very important to me that I think we need to do in this state. Not that I don't think Jay Nixon, I think he believed in it too, but I think Koster, maybe because he was a Republican, you know, and then became a Democrat, maybe he will be able to work across the aisle to get that.
So that could be a benefit there.
Yeah, and so, but those are things that are really important to me that the Republican nominee, you know, is not in line with me whatsoever. I mean, every one of the Republican nominees wanted right to work in this state. I don't think any of them will support Medicaid expansion. So I do have a sense of pragmatism to me too.
but do you have a sense that there's something to pay attention to in the popularity of Eric Greitens? I mean, he ran as an absolute outsider, mm-hmm. Very critical of Jefferson City. He continues mm-hmm. to be, even as he seeks to be governor.
Right.
What should you, as an elected official, be seeing and hearing in that?
Well, I think all of us have been, or most of us have been, taken aback by the politics of this election season, both at the national and state level. I would have never thought that an outsider like Greitens or Trump could rise to where they've risen. So there's obviously, you're right, there's this part of our country that is not happy with the way things are going and are very willing to put their belief and their trust in somebody who's never been in politics before. I personally think that it's not a bad thing to have had some elected office, have dealt with the political world if you're going to run for office. I don't necessarily think outsiders make the best politicians or best elected officials. That's my opinion. But obviously there's a part of the country that doesn't feel like I do. Mm-hmm. And they think it would be perfectly all right to put a Donald Trump or Eric Greitens in office who's never had any experience. I think it'll be a big mistake. And, you know, I kind of use our former mayor, Mark Funkhauser, as an example. A lot of people, I thought he was a great auditor, great person, but he really didn't have the political skills to be mayor. And then you look at Sly James, who really does have the political skills. And, you know, though he had not had office before, he'd you know, been an attorney, he'd done a lot of political things. So I think it takes that to be a good elected official.
While we're speaking about elections, I want to congratulate you. You won your primary.
Thank you.
You got 3,512 votes. That was 100%
that
of those votes that were cast.
There might have been a few write-ins that are not there yet.
you seem to be headed toward a 100% election in the general as well. What I'm saying is that you had no opposition in the primary, no opposition coming up in November. You're one of 5 Kansas City House Democrats in that situation. I am a little curious whether you think that's a good thing, or is there a problem when there isn't enough? Maybe it's not enough interest, not enough energy, maybe not enough money. Why are there no other Democrats seeking office to be in the House from Kansas City?
Well,
or Republicans,
yeah,
for that matter.
Yeah, you know, I do think being challenged is good. You know, I don't think it's necessarily good to not have challenges, because I think you can get lazy. I'm trying not to get lazy. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm out there still knocking doors, even though I'm running unopposed, putting out my yard signs, you know, doing all those things.
And why are you doing that?
Because I think you should interact with your constituents, and I think that's one of the ways you do it. You know, I mean, you obviously do it all year long through other ways, but I think getting out there and knocking doors, there's just really something to seeing somebody at their door and talking to them about their issues that is really important and is part of the democratic process. So, you know, I guess in a way we all kind of a sigh of relief. Well, we don't have to campaign, but yeah, I don't necessarily think it's a good thing. I agree with you. I think that sometimes, I think in our Democratic presidential election, although I was not a Bernie Sanders supporter myself, I certainly think he added immensely to the election and the primary season, and helped Hillary be a better candidate and brought some good ideas into the process, and I thought that was a healthy thing. So that probably means I'll have opposition in 2018.
Right. You heard it. It's an open invitation,
yeah.
Everyone.
She wants a challenge. Okay.
But I think it is a lot, because if you do have a really heavily Democratic district or a heavily Republican district, a lot of times the opposite party doesn't want to run against you.
Yeah.
You know, because it would be tough for me to, if I was in an 83% Republican district, it would be tough to run.
There's a why bother sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah.
I think
it's
snowball's chance in hell. Yeah. Might be the appropriate
and,
phrase.
Yeah, and you probably would think, well, it'd be better for funds and volunteers to go somewhere else where somebody could win, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Maria may have another question here, but I really do have a curiosity about one particular thing that's happened in the primary. It's on the Republican side of the ledger, but I think it has an impact on something that's near and dear to you, which is labor or anti-labor legislation, the right to work legislation. Two Republican incumbents here in the Kansas City area faced challenges in their primary, Jeff King from Liberty and Sheila Solon from Blue Springs. Mm-hmm. They were defeated in their primary by opponents who were funded by a particular businessman from Joplin, David Humphreys, who was opposing them because they voted to sustain Governor Nixon's veto of the right to work legislation. You of course, were with the governor. You voted to sustain the veto. So did several Republicans.
Yes.
That's why the veto was sustained. But it cost them. It cost them their Republican nomination. What do you make of that? And what do you make of the state of the labor movement in Missouri and how it's going to fare in Jefferson City?
Well, you know, I think the labor movement has done a good job of going into of analyzing districts and figuring out where their members live, and then going to those particular legislators and saying, hey, you know, a lot of union folks live in your district, and these are our thoughts on these particular bills. I think that in the case of Sheila Solon and Nick King, I don't remember exactly the amount of money that David Humphreys spent, but it was enormous.
Right. I think it was $25,000 in one race. It was $50,000 in another, or something.
Yeah,
like
it was a lot of money. And so I think, regrettably, I think sometimes it's very difficult to fight real big money. It's not impossible. I mean, there are. Look at Eric Cantor, what was his position in the House, U.S. House?
He was the Republican minority leader,
yeah,
think, or majority leader.
Right, right. And he got beat by somebody who spent much less money than he did. But so sometimes it happens. In his case, I think it happened because he was not connecting with his constituents anymore. He was not going back to his district. You know, he was meeting with all the lobbyists and doing all the leadership things, and I think that hurt him. But I think the money in politics really can hurt people, and I think it did in the case of those two individuals.
You don't think it necessarily registers that there's a growing sentiment against labor?
I don't think so. I think probably that there's a little bit more positive support for labor, because I think labor is really trying to get out there and, you know, talk about the things that they care about and how it helps people, you know, helps workers. So I don't think it's necessarily a trend, no. But it will still be a fight. And if a Republican governor gets, if Greitens gets in there, we'll probably be a right-to-work state.
So that's a key campaign issue,
yes,
in the governor's race, as
yes,
you see it.
Yes, yes.
Do you anticipate any change in the composition of the House and Senate?
Well, I hope there's a change.
I
am hopeful that we will be able to pick up some seats. You know, we're at 45 right now out of 163, and I think it's 8 out of 34 in the Senate.
That's right.
So I think we have a chance to pick up a Senate seat in the Columbia area with Stephen Weber, who was one of our House reps who was termed out. He's running against another House rep, Caleb Rowden. Right. And Weber is he's great. He's a good candidate. He's fought in, I don't know if he was in Afghanistan or Iraq, but he's a vet, you know, young guy who went to the war then. And so I think we might pick up, and I think it's just going to have to be a process where we slowly pick up seeds.
Mm-hmm. One more time around the table here, Maria Carter, any other questions?
Yeah. How do you think the top of the ticket's going to affect some of these statewide and more local races in Missouri?
Yeah. That's really interesting. You know, I just read something recently, a survey that said most people don't split their tickets.
Yeah.
You know, like if they vote for the Democrat for president, they'll vote for those statewide races democratically,
mm-hmm, yeah,
too, or vice versa Republican. So that would kind of lead you to believe that if Hillary Clinton's ahead, then we are probably going to benefit from that in statewide races. But this year has been so crazy. I mean, I just don't think anybody knows for sure what's going to happen.
Yeah, it seems like the rule book has been thrown
away.
Yeah,
it's just been thrown out the window. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a number of polls that show, there's a number of them that show Hillary ahead by quite a bit. And then if you look at some of those Senate races, it looks like there is some spillover that's helping those statewide, those U.S. Senate races, but it's not total. Like in Florida, I think Hillary's ahead, but Marco Rubio is still ahead for the Senate seat. Mm-hmm. Although it's like she's ahead by 5 points the latest. He was ahead by 3.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And do you think the U.S. Senate race in Missouri will be affected by that? Do you think Jason Kander could unseat Roy Blunt?
I think he can. Yes, I really do. I think that is one. And it's a combination of factors. Jason Kander's a very good candidate. You know, he's smart. He knows how to fundraise. He's a very hard worker, and he's got a compelling story, his own life story, you know, of
military veteran.
Yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm, right. And he's, you know, he's done a good job as Secretary of State. So I think he has a chance. I really do.
Well, we certainly shall see. I want to thank Representative Judy Morgan, a Democrat from Kansas City, for being with us. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I was glad to be here. Time always goes by fast.
It does. And my colleague, KCUR's Maria Carter. Thanks.
Glad to be here, too.
Now, Judy, as always, I know we kind of caught you off guard
this year ago. This time I'm not off guard.
She is prepared with her song to end the show.
She's been thinking about it for an entire year.
That's right.
What I should have said.
There's a lot of pressure now for it to be a really great song. What song are we ending with today?
Well, I think, have you ever heard of Leonard Cohen?
He's
a poet, songwriter.
Yes.
And I like a number of his songs, so let's try Everybody Knows.
Everybody Knows by Leonard Cohen. You got it. Thank you so much for being
here. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, follow the show that way. I'm at PTS Brian. You can follow my co-host, Sam Zeff, at Sam Zeff. We try to use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. We do have a little time on Thursday mornings. On Tuesday mornings on Up to Date. Catch a little of our show then. If you have any other thoughts or to be on the show as a citizen guest, send me an email. I'm at brian@kcur.org. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling. Their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets.